And this is particularly true for HR too, because as we progress with technology, technology will do more of the transactional work that we are doing today. And as technology does more of that transactional work, I am hoping that we don't fill it up with more transactional work, that now we start doing more transformational work. The value will be created in the opportunities that we are maximizing for our company, or in how we're solving complex problems that we have that go way beyond the transaction.
Constraint, Strive, Innovation. Hey everyone, it's Matt here for another episode of Thinking Inside the Box, a show where we discuss the innovative ways organizations and their leaders overcome complex issues at work. If you're interested in checking out our other content, you can find us at our shiny new website, insidetheboxpodcast.com, and on all of your favorite podcast platforms by searching Thinking Inside the Box. And if you enjoy the work we're doing here, consider leaving us a 5-star rating, a comment, and subscribing. It ensures you get updated whenever we release new content and really helps amplify our message. In today's episode, I chat with Enrique Rubio, HR, tech, and future of work expert, keynote speaker, and the founder of Hacking HR, a global learning community at the intersection of the future of work, technology, business, and organizations, with hundreds of thousands of members all over the world. Enrique is also the head of global community at Transform. Beyond all this, we've been friends for many years. We met in the days long before the pandemic, when Hacking HR was just getting off the ground, and found easy alignment with our shared passion for making a difference. And in the years since, we've individually branched out while also remaining connected through events, LinkedIn, and the occasional video chat. And this discussion, like many before it, talks about things such as the future of work and HR's role in defining it. Though we also explored Enrique's origin story, including his time in the corporate world, and how Hacking HR was formed. Some things that even I didn't know even after all these years as his friend. And it was another in a long line of memorable discussions. And I hope you enjoy it as much as we did recording it. Now I bring you Enrique Rubio. Enrique Rubio, how are you doing today?
What up, what up, what up, brother? I'm good. How are you?
It's been a while. I feel like we just talked, but also that it's been a really long time since we talked. Last I heard, you were in the East Coast around Washington. What took you out east?
I was there temporarily in my old kind of like neighborhoods, but I went there to support SAP and their Federal Forum event. I was hosting their HR, HXM human experience session. Great conversations about all the things that government is doing with technology in the HR space. Very exciting, because, you know, we generally think that, you know, government moves a little slower, which is true, but that they may not be necessarily doing a lot of innovative things. And that would not be true, because they are doing a lot of good things, even at the pace that they can move, because of, you know, stakeholders and scrutiny and, you know, all the things going on. But it was very exciting. So that's why I went to the East Coast. I was there in Washington, and then I came back home immediately. I become a homeboy, man. I live in Flagstaff, Northern Arizona. If any of your listeners know where this is, we are about an hour away from the Grand Canyon. We are at elevation 7,000 feet. Surround the city is built in the forest, in the Coconut International Forest, which is fantastic because temperature here is awesome all year long. So I really became a homeboy, and I like being here.
And you like running.
I don't like traveling anymore, man. Yeah, of course I'm running all the time, but I don't like traveling anymore. I think I'm like, I want to be home. Maybe, you know, 4 or 5 times to some conferences and different things, but then immediately back home.
Yeah, I think the world's kind of moving to that space too. I think we're all getting to a place now where technology becomes the primary interface for a lot of interactions. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the conference that's in Washington. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you heard in terms of trends, or you mentioned innovations happening in the public service space? You know, something maybe you can share with the group in terms of what things you saw or heard.
Yeah, perhaps the top thing of all the things that I've heard, perhaps the top one was how the government is thinking about skills and reskilling and upskilling to ensure preparedness, especially in the arm, in the military, you know, sectors, right, where you need to have a workforce that is completely ready with the right skills to, you know, for, you know, combat preparation, but also for all the strategic work they need to do for those who work in actual offices. So very exciting to hear about how they are kind of like getting their different agencies and departments ready for, you know, the upskilling and reskilling kind of trend. And the other one was on how they are bringing now artificial intelligence on board, right? I mean, it takes more time for them, particularly because there's a security issue that, you know, if you're going to bring artificial intelligence, I don't know, to the to a secret service agency, you know, it cannot be, you know, ChatGPT, right? It has to be something that really ensures, you know, maximum security for people's data and all those things. But what they said was, you know, we are, you know, doing some experiments with artificial intelligence in different sectors and then finding ways to amplify from there. So, I mean, in the private sector, you hear everybody's riding on the wave of artificial intelligence. You may think, well, maybe government will catch up in 50 years from now. But the reality is that many agencies have some people in their teams doing some of this research work and finding ways to kind of like take advantage of all the opportunities from artificial intelligence while simultaneously preserving all the important things that need to be preserved in government, you know, from a budget perspective, from a security perspective, from a governance and safety perspective. So that was very exciting to hear.
It's really interesting because I think of all the industries out there, I'd put the public service at the top or near the top of industries that will benefit most from artificial intelligence.
Absolutely.
Because to my way of thinking, where it has the biggest application are in industries where there's a lot of information that's latent, that's hard to surface, and where you benefit from a shorter path to an answer, conclusion, and insight. Yeah. So I think about public service, I think about the legal sector, I think about healthcare, I think about financial services, that education, where you want to have that shorter path to information. And I think you're right. I think there's a lot of innovation happening within the public sector.
Yeah.
And I also think that the criticism about the public sector around its slow rate of change is oftentimes well-earned. I contrast that though with, and I know you and I've had this conversation offline, but I recently had on the podcast Sim Sikut, who was the former CIO of the government of Estonia, which is doing incredibly innovative things for its citizens using technology. And I think I've gained a greater appreciation over the last couple of years, in particular with the pandemic and more interaction with our institutions, to have a sense of, you know, we can use technology more effectively in interacting with each other, with society, whether it's simple things like paying your property taxes or applying for a driver's license and all the things that today feel like a chore when you compare them against how easy it is to give Amazon our money, for example, one click and you can put things in your cart and all of a sudden Jeff Bezos gets your $49.99. But I think from the perspective of the public service, I think, you know, it'd be a welcome change to see some innovation in a space where certainly the tools that we as citizens interact with aren't great. I can only imagine the tools that the employees in those organizations work with can't be any better.
No.
They could obviously, I'm sure you heard lots of things about some of the challenges and some of the pain points for employees in those environments as well.
Well, you know, like in fact, one of the stories was that, you know, one of the presenters shared was, you know, our employees, they have like about 25,000 employees. And they were like, well, you know, all these people use Amazon or Uber or Lyft or, you know, Spotify or whatever it is, right? And as a consumer and as a user of other platforms, they are always one or two clicks away from what they want to achieve, right? I mean, you want to get a taxi, you know, two clicks away in Uber or Lyft. You want to buy whatever you want to buy in the world, you're one or two clicks away on Amazon. And then they come to work and then it is 200 clicks to get one thing done.
Yes.
But what happens is that we became a little spoiled, right? With the, because of these companies have created in us a sense of urgency when there may be no urgency all the time, but they created in us a sense of urgency of getting things quickly, of getting an immediate answer to what we're asking for. And then you come to work and then you're not getting the same kind of service. And by the way, sometimes this is even true for those very companies, right? I mean, inside their employees have to go through 100 clicks to do something that the people that they are serving as a company do it in two clicks, right? So anyway, all I'm saying here is that the expectation now is that our companies will provide us services as employees the same way that they are providing services to the clients they have. And that expectation will be very hard to realize, at least in the public sector, not because they don't want to do it, just because there's a scrutiny that is very different from a private sector, right? I mean, it's not that you can go and say, I'm going to spend X amount of money in doing this. I mean, you know, every cent has to go, you know, through, you know, the government planning, you know, the Congress and, you know, appropriations and all the different things, right? And you want to make sure that they're using the money, you know, properly, because it's our money at the end of the day. I just think that there are, the opportunities are phenomenal for government to truly go all in with technology. First, because they will be responding to talent needs, for example, that no human will be able to fill in just because there are either not enough humans to do the work or not enough humans that want to do the work or have the skills to do the work. So number one. But number two, imagine, you know, like you said before, imagine if instead of having to go through all these, you know, hurdles, you know, to get your driver's license, you have an AI assistant, you know, guiding you through the entire process, ensuring security and ensuring that you know everything. You probably will be saving taxpayers, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars by doing that through technology rather than having to go to the freaking DMV, right? You know, to get your driver's license. So anyway, I think the opportunities for all companies and all agencies in the both private and public sector are phenomenal with technology. I do know you just have to keep in the balance, you know, the safety, security, you know, data privacy, confidentiality, you know, I mean, the security of our country and, you know, all these things with the services that you will provide. I just think, I know it's possible. And I think these folks that are in government, they are figuring out how to do it, but they are already on that bandwagon, even though it moves a little slower than in the private sector.
Well, I think that democratizing factor of artificial intelligence, to your point, is going to shorten the gap or narrow the gap between the services that companies or institutions have traditionally provided externally than those that they provided internally. And I understand why. And you and I both have worked in HR before. We both worked in the public service before. Mm-hmm. So we have an understanding of how kind of the machine works. And a lot of the frustration points that exist in organizations today are going to be solved with things like, to your point, copilots, intelligent search, personalized learning pathways, just the ability to interact with information in a completely different way is going to free up a lot of time. What I get excited about and what I guess I'm looking for, maybe it's just a bit ambitious about the timing, but I'd love to hear a perspective from our public service around how they envision the role of technology playing and what the output will be insofar as its constituents. So presuming you add, and I don't, you know, want to speculate, but to me, it wouldn't be unreasonable to assume that you could pick up 10% productivity for a traditional public service worker if you introduce artificial intelligence into their daily work. It might be more. If you're a researcher or you're an analyst, then a lot of your role is going to be contracted using artificial intelligence. That's not to say we should see reduction of force, which in some jurisdictions we might. But where I get excited about, Enrique, because to me, this is just transformation on steroids. Like, what's the opportunity cost? What are we going to, if we can all pick up 10% more time, 20% more time, we could work 20% faster, or we could achieve 20% more.
Or you can save 20% to taxpayers, which sounds really good too.
Absolutely. And I think you're going to see, depending on party lines and depending on individual values, you'll see cases made for all of them, and they're all valid cases.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear a vision from people on, to your point, what is going to be realized, because I think the opportunity is compelling, and I think the outputs can be a win-win-win-win-win if we're intentional about understanding the incentives. I know it's really hard to get consensus around topics like this, but these are the kind of discussions that, to me, I see technology as an accelerant for a conversation, and it can go a million different ways. And I'm kind of sitting here with bated breath, figuring out which way it's going to go. It should be interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is that with technology, I think you may have a pitch that satisfies pretty much, you know, everybody in the reasonable political spectrum, right? I mean, for the guys who want smaller government, well, you can have smaller governments if you bring technology on board. I mean, that doesn't mean that you're going to be firing people, but it means most likely most agencies right now in government have openings that they can't fill up. And, you know, I mean, I don't have a number of this, right? But given my experience, and probably, you know, you would agree too, that if every private company has an opening right now that they can't fill up because they don't have, they are not, there's no people with those skills or that want to live in that city or whatever it is, the same is probably true for government to, for which the incentives for talent are different than in the private sector. But if this is true and you bring technology on board, maybe you don't even need to fill up that position anymore. Maybe you are already satisfying that need with technology. So then you have an answer of, can we have a little bit of a smaller government and, you know, give back some money to taxpayers, you know, by implementing technology. So number one, but then you have the people that tell you, we want to spend more in government because we want to serve our people better. We want to expand our services. Well, with technology now, you can do it much more effectively and efficiently when you bring technology and you ensure a proper collaboration between a human and the technology. Imagine, for example, you know, those who want to expand the government footprint by having agencies, for example, provide mental health services, right? Imagine if you bring technology on board and now you have, you know, intelligent, artificial intelligent assistants helping you out, I don't know, screen people and kind of like, you know, help them navigate through the complexities of all the mental health landscape with government and whatnot. So now you can expand, and this is just one example, by the way, but there are a million different examples. This is just one example of how you can expand your services footprint as a government institution without expanding the bill that we all have to pay. You know, you can just build, bring technology, you can expand, I don't know, by just making it up, right? By, I don't know, 50% your service capability by only increasing, I don't know, 5% your cost, you know, something along those lines. And that sounds good. So you are really having smaller governments while having larger services. And I think that should be good for conservatives and progressives, right? I mean, I think it's a good pitch for everybody. I know there are concerns, you know, like people saying, I mean, what will happen with jobs and what will happen with safety and who are we going to be paying technology-wise and are we making somebody else billionaire, you know, by hiring them to do these services? And well, you know, it's all trade-offs, right? No solution will ever be perfect. But if you want to have smaller governments and you want to have larger impact and services, well, there's no way around technology. You're going to have to just bring it on board, even if you are not 100% sort of like satisfied with everything. You will have to give up on something. And that's the way everything works, particularly in government. You won't ever get 100% of everything you want.
Hey everyone, it's Matt here. I hope you're enjoying today's conversation. And before we continue, I want to update you on my latest creative project, This Week at Work. Every Friday at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, that's 10 a.m. Eastern and 3 p.m. GMT, my good friend Chris Rainey of HR Leaders and I discuss the latest trending topics on the minds of executives globally, from organizational culture to technology and the future of work. We cover it all. And we invite some of our favorite colleagues to join us, from Dave Ulrich to Whitney Johnson, and executives from iconic brands such as NASA, Krispy Kreme, and WebMD. What can I say? We like to keep things interesting. And if you've been following us for a while, you'll no doubt recognize the fun partnership Chris and I have developed over years podcasting together. We're not afraid to be real, share our own challenges, and ask the tough questions. Joining? Well, that part's easy. Follow me on LinkedIn, click the bell icon on the top right of my profile, and you'll get notified when we go live. And now, back to our discussion. Well, I guess what excites me is government, by definition, is about incremental change. You actually don't want government to change that quickly because it makes people afraid about the institutions in which they support. And and there's obviously a place for progressive thinking, especially around a number of issues that are relevant given all the changes happening in broader society today. That said, what I think is really interesting is this phase of time that we're in right now is offering up far greater than incremental change.
Yeah.
And it really comes down to your point around adoption and around use cases. And I love what you said earlier about ethics and the application of it. And, you know, for every technology advancement we've seen in society, whether it's the electricity or the telephone or the internet, and keep going, we've seen lots of positive effects And then we've seen some effects that are not that positive. Yeah. One of the fears I have is that in a case where, to your point, of all the choose your own adventure of the benefits that AI can afford you, one of them might be, hey, I want you to work two times as fast now. Yeah. So I'm not going to reduce your workload. I just expect twice as much in the time that's been allocated. So I'm going to give you the same 40, 50, 60 hour work week, but I'm going to expect you to do the same that you do in 2 weeks now in 1 week, because you now have AI to support you. I don't want you to take 4 days to write a report. Now it should take you 2 days. I don't want you to do this versus that. And I think there will be obviously certain people that look to this as a productivity enhancement tool. And I think to those individuals, I would just say to look at a balanced scorecard of application of benefit here. You can have all of these things. You can be more productive. You can save money. You can make work better. You can drive more value to the customers. You can be less wasteful. You know, one thing that I'm a big fan of is just removing the unnecessary spend from budgets. And whether that's in a corporate setting or in a public service setting, I was very big on, if we're not getting use for that spend, let's reallocate that to something that could get use for it, whether it's, to your point, employee engagement or benefits or mental health or any of the number of very, you know, worthy causes. I love the idea of technology as an opportunity to remove that inefficient spend where it's, you know, value, not value for dollar. I think that's where technology has a big advantage, is it can provide significant value for, to your point, limited investment.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I think it's, again, you know, when you come to these conversations, and I don't work, you know, I'm not a politician, and I don't have to get into these negotiations. Thanks goodness, you know, that I don't have to do that, because I know it's rough. But you can have an answer to everybody's concerns, even if you don't get 100% of what you want to get out of it, right? But you get almost all that you may want while preserving your principles, right? I mean, again, if you are somebody who believes in a small government, you can preserve some of the principles of what you're trying to do, saving, you know, people, you know, tax money by implementing technology. Simultaneously, if you believe in the role of government, not because you want to have more government employees, but because you want to expand the footprint of the services provided by the government, then you have an answer here too. I mean, now, if you come to the table thinking, I want to have more employees, but also more technology, maybe you won't get what you want, right? I mean, because the entire point here is to make sure that we can do as much as we can with as little resources as we can make that happen. I don't think anybody would have that expectation, though. I think the expectation, the reasonable expectation would be, again, from one side, having a smaller government to save taxpayers' money. From a different side, it is making sure that the government is there to provide services to the people and regulate industries. And you can have all of this, of course, with technology. So it takes time, you know, it's going to take time. I mean, it's taking time to private companies, you know, they take time to do this, you know, and they have a strong incentive, you know, to do this, to make more money. So for government, where the incentive is not to make money, the incentive is a little bit different. And in addition to that, you have, you know, thousands of eyes looking at what you're doing, you know, for you to make the first mistake, to keep you accountable for that. The timing, the timeline of this is different. But I'm excited about where, you know, where technology is going in terms of the impact that it'll have, that it'll have in both private and public sector.
Your background is unique. Engineering.
Yeah. Electronic HR engineer.
electronic engineer, HR executive, community leader.
Yeah.
Podcast host.
Yeah.
MC for events for some of the largest technology companies in the world. How does it all come together? How does it all make sense?
There's a lot of... No, I'm just kidding.
It doesn't. On paper, it seems like there's lots of contradictions, but I know that with you, it all comes together. So I'm just curious how you marry all those disparate parts and, you know, what does it look like?
Well, I think about the concept of transferable skills, right? And you know, I was a practitioner of electronic engineering for many years. And if you ask me today to do what I did 15 years ago as an engineer or 20 years ago, I would not be able to do some of the things that I used to do because I don't have that in mind anymore. Like, in fact, I recently bought a book on calculus just because I wanted to do what I was able to do pretty quickly. By the way, I loved math when I was doing my engineering degree, and I was trying to resolve some of these problems, and I look at them and I'm thinking, 20 years ago, I would have been able to do this in 2 minutes. And now I'm spending an hour to try to solve this thing because I don't remember anymore how to do it. But there's a thing. So that's a very kind of like tangible, practical thing, perhaps, that I am not able to do anymore. But what I am able to do is there's a thinking process that you have as an engineer. And that thinking process is what I still have very relevant today, as I did years ago. And it's kind of like the thinking process that I try to use when I do my work as a community builder in HR, even as an MC, even when we're preparing an event, you know, I go through, like you told me this before, like, Enrique, you made it so easy to sign up for one of your events. And all I keep thinking is that's probably not the HR mindset. That's the engineering mindset that came in and said, how can I build something that makes it very seamless for people to perform a task, an activity or something, right? Similarly, when I am doing something in technology, generally, I am asking, for example, when I use ChatGPT, which I use pretty much every day now, the kind of questions that I'm asking to ChatGPT are not the kind of questions that I would have asked to ChatGPT had I done this 20 years ago. I'm asking the kind of questions that I would ask as an HR professional, right? I'm asking the kind of questions that are a little different, you know, like, for example, maybe I am more sensitive today to human emotions because of my work in HR than how sensitive I was to this, you know, 20 plus years ago when I did all work about engineering. So when I do something on ChatGPT and I get an answer, I'm like, yeah, but we need to fine tune this because it doesn't sound that it's something that I want to put out in the way you're defining it, right? So there's a component of HR mindset that comes in the use of that technology. So the way it comes all the way that I bring it all together is just by making sure that some of the principles that I've learned throughout my career, they are transferable and I'm bringing them across the board from one side of activities to the other set of activities. If I'm working with technology, that I can bring some of my mindset of HR, that if I'm working with HR things, I'm bringing some of my engineering mindset, and that's how I keep it all together. I'm not able anymore, again, you know, to solve the same engineering problems that I was solving more than 20 years ago. I just lost that muscle. I don't remember anymore how to do it, but there's a mindset on how to approach that problem that still is relevant to me. Same thing with HR, right? I mean, there are things that I used to do in HR when I was a practitioner of the field that I may not be able to do anymore because now I'm a community builder. But the mindset that I had when I resolved those problems in HR in the past continues to be relevant today as I am building community. And whenever I do the next thing, I don't know what the next thing will be in, you know, 5 years, 10 years from now, but maybe I become, which I've always wanted to do, by the way, open a coffee shop. Maybe I open a coffee shop and maybe I don't do engineering anymore. Maybe I don't do HR anymore, but when I, or maybe I don't build community anymore, but when I open my coffee shop, I am sure that what I learned as an engineer, what I learned as an HR leader, what I learned as a community builder will all come together to serve the purpose of making sure that coffee shop is successful. So that's how I bring it all together.
You know, you can use ChatGPT for calculus, right?
But it's this thinking that I am thinking about in here. You know, like
I'm just bugging you.
I know you are, but there's a guy. This is why I did it. I don't remember his name. His name is Kevin something. He's a very big guy in all people analytics and stuff. I don't remember his last name. He posted something like about a year ago on his LinkedIn. And he said every morning, very early in the morning, I solve one mathematical problem. The problem doesn't matter. The reason why I'm doing it is to keep my analytical skills sharp. And I was like, wow, that's very interesting because I haven't solved a mathematical problem of that nature, not 2 + 2 = 4, right? But a different calculus problem. Sure. I haven't done that in years. So I bought this book and I have it next to my, you know, on my bed table. And I don't do it every morning, but I try to do it very often that I just pick one problem. And even if I can't solve it, I am thinking about thinking. I am thinking about how to approach that kind of problem. And that keeps some skills very sharp in me. And I think it's very useful.
25 years ago in HR, the profession was filled with a lot of people that were career HR leaders. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't have education. Mm-hmm. And of course, over time, HR became more of a, you know, undergraduate degree and graduate degree. But in the early days of HR, it was a very, I would say, exclusive function, mm-hmm. in the same way that finance was and marketing was, but HR had its own silo.
Yeah.
In the last 15 years in particular, you've seen a real shift in the demographics. You've seen a number of different kinds of people enter into HR, and that's been for a few reasons. You've seen individuals like yourself coming in from different functions, whether it's technology or like me in operations, or you see individuals come in from sales or marketing. You also see a lot of organizations curating cross-functional experiences for executives, saying, hey, as part of your rotational opportunity on the path to becoming a CEO or a C-suite executive, you need a rotation in HR to learn a different part of the business.
Yeah.
You've also seen the shift in the profession from one that was highly preferred to have deep technical expertise. We had people that were in, you know, labor law roles, employee relations roles, compensation roles, payroll roles, deep technical expertise. And the role, the profession has since evolved into more of a generalist function where people are expected to be actually experts in a number of different areas, from influence and persuasion to conflict negotiation to labor law to training and development and recruitment and all the other myriad of things that come up. Where do you see it going in the future? Where's the profession as far as HR is concerned? How do you see it playing out in the next 10 years?
I think we have to double down on all, and I'm going to put it in quotes because I know that that's not the right way to say it, but I'm going to say it either way. We have to double down on all things soft skills. I know it's not soft skills. I know it's human skills, power skills, you know, whatever you want to call it. But we know when we talk about soft skills, we all know what we're talking about, right? And I think we have to double down on that because the complexity of the problems that we are dealing with will only increase. The amount of available information to resolve those problems will only increase. The amount of problems that we're dealing with, business challenges and or opportunities that we're dealing with, will only increase. And there is no way for anybody, anywhere, this is true for all functions and it will be true for HR, there is no way for us to have all the answers to all the questions at the time that we're being asked those questions. There is no way for all of us to know all the challenges and all the opportunities that will be coming up going forward. So one of the most powerful things that we're going to have to do going forward is bringing people together from different walks of life, different areas of expertise, and together try to solve some of those business challenges that we're dealing with, or amplify and, you know, quote unquote, exploit those opportunities, those business opportunities that we're seeing in front of us. And having only technical skills to do that will not be enough, because you will never know enough, deep enough, to be able to resolve one of those complex, you know, multifaceted business challenges that we're dealing with. So to me, what we have to do going forward is invest a lot in our quote unquote soft skills, in our leadership skills, so that we are able to influence the kind of decisions that the organization is making, to bring people together, to get the best out of them in their technical areas of expertise. And that way, then we solve the problem. We become less of a technical expert and more of the integrator, the facilitator, the coach that perhaps is bringing everybody together to solve those problems. And this is particularly true for HR too, because as we progress with technology, technology will do more of the transactional work that we are doing today. And as technology does more of that transactional work, I am hoping that we don't fill it up with more transactional work, that now we start doing more transformational work, meaning, all right, if we figure out, for example, let me give you one very transactional slash strategic example. If we bring technology on board to run all our payroll kind of processes in a very smoothly way, the next question for us is not adding more transaction or how to turn the system into, you know, perhaps becoming more efficient, because maybe it already reached its peak of efficiency. Maybe the next stage is, how do we design an organization where people have the kinds of rewards and incentives that truly motivate them, extrinsically motivate them to stay here and do their best? So that's a very different question than just asking a question about payroll. So then you start asking yourself something that is way more strategic, builds more of a stronghold of an organization for the long term. And to respond to that question, you most likely won't be able to do it by yourself. You will have to bring people together. You will have to bring the CEO, the board with you and ask them, you guys are experts in your industry. What are the people in your industry say that is, I don't know, manufacturing? What are people in manufacturing expecting from their employers? And now you have an insight. And then you bring the finance guy, and then you bring the IT people, and then you bring the marketing people, and you put together all these insights, and then you say, I don't just want to make payroll in this company more effective and more efficient. I want to make sure that we're designing a rewards and incentive system that caters to what people want and why they would move to a company like ours. So those kinds of questions are very, very different. And to make payroll more efficient, maybe you have to have deep expertise in payroll and in the system that you're using. To respond to the second question, which is how do we design systems of rewards and benefits and incentives that bring people to this company, then your deep expertise will only get you so far. Now it is your conversations. Now it is your capacity to research. Now it is how you relate to other people in the industry. Call it whatever you want, right? But that's sort of the direction in which I think we're going to be going to, and we should be going to, becoming more of an expert, bring people together rather than an in-depth expert of payroll. I just think that sort of model of in-depth expertise on technical areas in HR, that should die. You know, that should die very soon, just because we have technology now to answer all the transactional questions that we may have. But the value will not be created in the answers of those transactional questions. The value will be created in the opportunities that we are maximizing for our company, or in how we're solving complex problems that we have that go way beyond the transaction. That's how I see the role of HR. And I'm going to add one more thing here, which you've heard me say many times in the past, and I'm going to say it again. I think of HR as a trailblazer. I think of HR as the function that is in the most unique, if that's even a logical thing to say, the most unique function right now in any business is HR. And the reason for that is because we are sitting at the intersection of how our companies operate and how people operate. And most value for most companies is created at that intersection. When you look at the top 10 things that most CEOs are concerned about, 7 of them have to do with people, whether they can attract and retain the right talent, whether they can deliver right performance and productivity, whether they can keep their workforce well from a well-being holistic perspective, whether they can have the skills they need and have all the learning and development tools they need. All of them have to do with people. And that's because they know that as of today, their response to creating values and organization still depends on people. And HR is the only function sitting at that intersection of people and business operation. And if this is true, that's where value is created, and it will be true for a long time, by the way. It may not be true forever, but that's where value is created today. Then HR has an extraordinary opportunity to say, I can become a trailblazer, a leader that is helping everybody in business connect the dots between people and business operation. We are sitting at that unique intersection, and that's where value is created, and we can become the trailblazers, leading everybody forward into future of work, the new reality of work. That to me is exciting, and we won't be able to do that if all we look at is in-depth technical expertise on transactional areas in HR. We need to look at maybe less in-depth expertise in those technical areas and more horizontal expertise across different areas, particularly in all things soft skills, to bring people together. Because then if we're the leaders, we got to bring people together. We really have to be those trailblazers, right? And there's no way that I can approach a conversation with a finance guy telling him, I know a lot about payroll, therefore I can be your leader. You know, you tell them like, hey, I need your insights to respond to these very difficult problems that we're dealing with right now. Then the conversation is completely different. So anyway, that's how I envision, and I am hoping the future of HR becomes that.
As an event host, as a podcaster, you've interviewed hundreds of leaders over the course of your career. Mm-hmm. And you recently made the potentially unwise decision to come out of retirement and join myself and Chris Rainey for the Future Work Show, which we recently announced.
Yeah, I was retired from podcasts, by the way.
That's what I said. I pulled you out of retirement. We convinced you to come out of retirement. How did we do that?
Well, because you and Chris are awesome. And, you know, I love you, man. I mean, you and I have been friends for a very long time. I think you are amazing. Chris is amazing. My relationship with him is newer. He's a change maker. You know, I actually have spoken with people that tell me, man, that guy is a beast. You know, he is like really creating amazing things. And for me to be able to be in the same room with you and Chris talking about cool things and bringing awesome guests to a show, it's just a no-brainer. And it is a no-brainer from the perspective of how much I think I will learn. Not I think, I know I will learn from you and Chris, but also the kinds of questions that you will be asking these leaders, questions that I would have never thought about that will help me do better the work that I am doing. So I'm imagining, you know, the three of us interviewing one leader, you guys asking a question, and I'm like, wow, I never thought about that thing before. And that one question that you asked and the response we get from that leader invited to that conversation will most likely inform a new event that he put together, a new initiative, a new learning program, whatever it is. So to me, it's really a no-brainer to be in that room with you guys, because I think you are amazing. Your reputation precedes you. You know, like, you are respected as, you know, as more than probably most people that I know in the HR space. And I think the three of us, you know, in a more kind of like transactional answer, the three of us probably together have the largest HR network in the world. I am, without a doubt, I say this, the three of us together bring more people to our events and our podcasts and our learning programs than anybody else anywhere in the HR world. And that to me is exciting, because the impact we can have together is much larger and faster than any impact that we can do individually if we were separated from each other. So this was, you know, I mean, this was meant to happen at some point. You told me this like 5 years ago, like, I know at some point we're going to get together. The time has to be the right time, and now it's the right time. And I'm super excited about, you know, kicking off our conversations.
When's the right time to sell Hacking HR merchandise?
Oh man, you've been telling me for that forever, but we're very close to that.
I'm going to get that. Whatever you let me know, I'm going to get some. But back to the original piece, Chris and I are so excited as well. I think, as you said, we've been friends for years, and we've always had common values. And I also think that you bring a unique perspective to the conversation that we'll all benefit from. Yeah. And whether it's because you were born in a different place from all of us, and we have now UK, Canada, Latin America, the United States well represented, like, yeah, we really want to bring a global perspective to global problems, because the world is shrinking. And yeah, I love when we bring guests on from Central Europe and North America and Asia Pacific and the Middle East. And we really try, and to your point, have innovative and thoughtful conversations around challenging topics. Mm-hmm. And I know that you are somebody who does not shy away from the bigger questions. And we were looking forward to just partnering with you on this and seeing where we can take. What I'm most excited about, Enrique, as I think about this, is we can really raise the level of the conversation.
Oh, we can, yeah. Yeah.
I think that's what HR has really been asking for, is how do we raise the level of conversation, and how do we all come together on this journey and help support each other? And you've modeled that better than anyone that I can think of. So I'm super excited about the opportunity. And yeah, thanks again for agreeing to do it.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you. Thank you. And Chris, for Chris Rainey and you, Matt, for inviting me to be part of this and taking me out of a podcast retirement. You know, doing podcasts is a very hard thing to do. And I was doing one podcast every day, and I did so for 2 years. So it was a lot of work. Not only that, it was a lot of different ideas to have in mind that I couldn't retain anymore. So I was going a little crazy. And I said, I think now I'm getting too distracted by these conversations. But now I know we're going to have the right cadence, and it's going to be an incredible product and service and conversation that we're going to put out for the community to all of us grow together. So thank you so much for that.
For folks that want to find you, what's the best place to do that?
Just go to LinkedIn, you know, Enrique Rubio. You can find me, check out Hacking HR LinkedIn and the website. We are about to release our new website in the next couple of weeks, which is going to be pretty cool. And that's it. You know, that's how they can, you know, connect with me.
Very good. Thank you again.
Thank you, my friend.
Bento HR is a digital transformation consultancy working at the intersection of strategy, technology, and people operations. We partner with organizations, private equity, and venture capital firms to accelerate value creation and identify the organization's highest leverage initiatives. And this can take place in many forms, from strategic planning and alignment to technology procurement, implementation, and integration, along with organizational design, process reengineering, and change management. With our proven track record of working with complex, high-growth organizations,
we provide a lens that goes beyond the balance sheet, increasing enterprise readiness, resilience, and value. For more information, check us out at bentohr.com.